Testing, 1, 2, 3. Gosh, I sound like such... Okay, does it sound like anything from here? Can you guys hear me? I mean, I'm kind of a loud mouth anyway. Is that, that's okay? Kosher. Good, good, good. Okay. Great. Right, well, we're going to go?
Yeah, I guess, if you're ready.
Hi, I'm Allison Deming, director of the University of Arizona Poetry Center. For those of you who are new to our events, I'd like to welcome you. And in particular, I'd like to thank Antigone's and the wonderful women who run this terrific bookstore for their hospitality once again in hosting our summer resident for a reading. Some of you are familiar with our summer residency program. I just want to briefly say a couple of words about it. This is the fourth year, is that right, Karen? Fourth actual year of the Poetry Center's summer residency program, in which through a national juried competition, we select one writer, poet, fiction writer, or nonfiction writer, to spend a month in residence at our guest house with no obligation other than to have free time to focus entirely on his or her writing. And this was the first year we selected a fiction writer. Anyone who's interested in finding out information about the residency can call us at the center. One of the people who was very instrumental in helping us make the decision this year is going to be the introducer of Caroline Langston. So let me introduce to you Bob Houston, who is the director of the Creative Writing Program at the university.
And then I will introduce someone who will really introduce Carol. Caroline Langston is a native of Yazoo City, Mississippi. Yes, Virginia, there is a Yazoo City. Inescapable. She was educated at Phillips and at Tulane and has her MFA from the University of Houston. She now teaches at Rose Hill College in Aiken, South Carolina, teaches literature and writing. She won a pushcart for her story, The Disillusion of the World, which is a great title. It's published in the Oxford American, Sonora Review, Plowshares, Gettysburg Review, and elsewhere. She's at work on a novel called The Memory of Whiteness and new short stories. She will be a scholar at the Breadloaf Writers Conference this summer. Caroline Langston.
I told Michael Spurgeon that my true desire was to come up here and do my air guitar rendition of Enigata De Vita, which I might be slightly more comfortable with, but that I shall refrain for the benefit of everyone here. I was thinking of a quotation, and it's slightly pretentious, but one that I've always kind of come back to. There are things known and there are things unknown, and in between there are the doors. From Aldous Huxley, which of course Jim Morrison adopted, to come up with the name of the band, The Doors. But I wanted to say a few thoughts on what revelation is to writers and why this is significant. I thought we could think about the figure of Moses, in a sense, patriarch of the three world's great monotheistic religions, and that the figure of Moses, in a sense, is a paradigm for our work as writers, because his life is a series of multiple alienations. I think to be born into as a member of the chosen people, yet to not have access to that heritage, to be raised in sort of the intimate, cosmopolitan, and sophisticated world of the Egyptian court, yet feel because of one's blood and one's birth that one's set on that. And so to feel that inextricable fighting within oneself of multiple heritages. And at the very moment that Moses sort of comes to an understanding of his Jewish identity and slays the Egyptian who's persecuting another Jew, the Jewish man turns around and says, "Who are you? You live with them." So what does he do? He escapes to the land of Midian. He's stuck out there, married away from his heritage again, and yet, in the burning bush, revelation pursues him. Now, if we look at this aesthetically rather than religiously, that's sort of the work that all of us are in touch with. Seeking the burning bush, in a sense, seeking that authentic contact with the divine. So what does Moses do? He obeys the message in the burning bush. His shoes are off. And I think Flannery O'Connor echoes this wonderfully at the end of Parker's Back, where Parker has been fighting and fighting, sort of this haunting thing that's pursued him. And what happens is the tractor throws him off, the tree explodes into flames, and his shoes are thrown off. So he has to submit to that. And I think all artists, whatever their religious persuasion, have to come in contact with that kind of sense of religious communion. So Moses goes ahead and leads his people. As writers, most of us come from privileged backgrounds, and in a sense, we often are unwilling to rise to the responsibility that coming from a privileged nation and a privileged heritage requires. And I think there's a sense of social responsibility about that. So Moses goes to the top of the mountain and gets the law. And what do? He comes back down off the mountain and finds that nobody believes him. Everybody's mind is turned to something else. And I think that also can stand for a number of the multitude of betrayals that each of us faces when our family doesn't understand our work, when our friends don't understand our work, that we, in a sense, are sort of placed in the position of having to follow this transcendental revelation, that anybody buys it or not. But in that sense, I think I'm also think of, in The Great Gatsby, the great scene, that's sort of a wild transition to go from the Hebrew scriptures to The Great Gatsby. But that moment when Nick Carraway is at the party and there's this drunk guy in a car and he's trying to drive somewhere and his car's in a ditch. And he said, let me back it out. And somebody else says, but the wheel's off. And he says, but there's no harm in trying. So I guess as far as one's transcendental contact with revelation, even though we're faced with a culture that basically says this is BS, then there's no harm in trying, nonetheless. I'm reading a story called The Haitian Necklace. Those of you who know my writing that I submitted as part of my application for the Poetry Center, this is perhaps will be a slightly different for some of you, but it's a story that I think is fun, and so I thought for a public venue like this it would be. And it's dedicated to a former student of mine named James McConnell, and it's called The Haitian Necklace. Kenny's mother stood at the head of the stairs behind him, looking for all the world, he thought, like one of those helmet-headed goddesses in the operas to which his father was always listening. Kendall Sebastian Brooks, she threatened, stabbing a cigarette-stained yellow finger in the air as she distended. Stop right there this minute. 55 years old, tall, and embarrassingly chesty in her Shetland sweater, she appeared as though at any moment she might try to swoop down off the landing and spear him in the side. Even so, Kenny was too fast for her. He bounded down the stairs two and three at a time with great sloppy steps, landing so hard on the parquet floor that the walls shuddered, and when he attempted to snatch the car keys off the hall table, a framed brass rubbing of an English fell off its hook and came crashing down upon his hand. Damn it, he said, as the car keys skittered across the mahogany table and fell in a thunk on the Persian rug. Momentarily arrested, he yanked out his fingers, which hurt, from under the heavy wood frame, trying not to pay attention to his mother's anguished gaze, the expression, he thought, of a bug impaled upon a straight pin, pathetic and wriggling. Kenny was in 10th grade biology and had recently to complete an insect collection. Sebastian, she called out helplessly, and when she did, the room fractured. The sound of her voice made Kenny's very head hurt. There was no answer. Sebastian, she repeated through the living room door, behind which Kenny's father sat leafing through an issue of the National Review as the McNeil-Lehrer News Hour blared away on television. For a brief, incredible moment, there was silence, and to his horror, Kenny could actually visualize himself sitting down on the tufted hall and actually listening to her, as the therapist had once suggested to him. Then, as if by delayed reaction, his father lumbered into the hall, loosening his tie. The bottom of his starched white shirt, untucked, hung like a wrinkled skirt over the top of his suit trousers. He screwed up his eyes and glanced hard at Kenny, frowning and speechless, as though his son were under a microscope and Kenny's father couldn't quite find him. Kenny, meanwhile, stood firm and stared his parents down, his mother suspended in the air like an astonished angel, and his dad creeping across the floorboards like that old cartoon of Father Time, both of them open-mouthed, ridiculous, and revolting. Then slowly, defiantly, he bent to pick up the Peugeot keys. "What is it, Nancy?" his father finally answered. His mother did not answer but continued to glare at Kenny. "You are not taking the car," she said. "Not after that stunt you pulled last time. You are not in the car." "Okay," he shrieked, and threw out his arms dramatically, as he always did during these confrontations, which were choreographed to the smallest detail, every instant an eternal return of the same. Only this time he stumbled over his own giant athletic shoes, dropped the keys again, and felt like a loser. "So I'm not taking the car." Instead, he strode right out the front door, smacked the edge of his skateboard leaning against the porch pillar, and caught it in his hands as he descended the old house's steep porch stairs, only once glancing back at his motionless parents, broken by the leaded glass doors into 1,000 beveled pieces. He punched in the code on the front gate lock, and the iron bars rang shut behind him. Then he was off, helmetless, careening in the October twilight down the Jefferson Street Hill, the oldest neighborhood in Jackson, at the bottom of which was the Jitney Jungle grocery store, where he hit the payphone and used his parents' AT&T calling card number to call his friend I. Jackson Lee to come and pick him up. "That stunt you pulled last time," to which his mother referred, was the reason that, though 15 and possessed of his license, he was not being allowed to drive. In Mississippi, you could get your license at 15, and it was damned embarrassing to have to hitch rides and be dropped off by her every day at school in the ancient rusted Saab whose bumper bore the legend, "A man without a gun is a citizen, a man without a gun is a subject." Nevertheless, as far as the consequences of the last time went, Kenny knew he was exceptionally lucky. Friday night of the first weekend of the school year, coincidentally the first time he was allowed to drive the Peugeot to the football game, the most unpopular boy at Country Day, Wade Rivers, had thrown a party while his parents were out of town. 175 people from high schools all over Jackson had showed up at Wade's house out in the fancy Madison suburbs, and Kenny had gotten wasted on 8 Milwaukee's best. None of the stuck-up sub-debs from rival Jackson Prep would talk to him, of course, and he lost his best friend, Isaiah, his best friend, in the crowd. When the police showed up and started dragging off people left and right, Kenny'd had to dive out a window and stumble 10 blocks in unfamiliar darkness to a strip mall, call his parents collect, and ask them to come pick him up. This comprised the whole of the last time, but after nearly 2 months, Kenny was still not being allowed to drive. "Heck, I didn't even get arrested, unlike Wade," he grumbled to himself, standing at the Jitney Jungle payphone waiting for Isaiah to answer. "You mean she changed her mind again?" Isaiah said on picking up, laughing. "All right, you just chill. I'll be there in a minute. Your mama is crazy." Too true, it occurred to Kenny, as it occurred to Kenny many times before. His mother really was crazy, and the last time was merely the latest. Kenny's parents hadn't even gotten married until they were old already, and Kenny was their only child, with the result that he, unlike everyone else's, had no idea how to do anything and was paranoid about everything. She may have come from an old Jackson family, the Westerbergs, of which she was continually reminding him, and who had once owned the most famously elegant hotel in town. But some of Kenny's earliest memories were of his mother helplessly imploring Ruthie, their black maid, for advice on how to deal with him. She had also made the mistake of having his IQ tested while he was still too young to know what was going on. The number had come back exceptionally high, she had told him what it was, and now he could not get out from under it, no matter how hard he tried. The IQ score existed on some high, shining summit of her mind, predictive of his future expectations. No matter how many failing papers he pulled from his knapsack at the end of the day, wadded up and lacerated with red pen from one end to the other, the score would not be jarred. The worst thing of all, though, was that Kenny's mother was the president of the local chapter of the John Birch Society. She even had her own television show that came on the public access channel Friday nights at 11 after the Reverend Louis Farrakhan hour, and before a local self-appointed black political commentator named Elisha Speaks, who sat in front of an upside-down American flag, ranting and raving about gangs, drugs, the city council, the racist police chief, and America in general, which he spelled, he said, with a K. And in the middle of it all was Kenny's mother smiling in a gold button suit, pronouncing the John Birch motto, "Less government, more responsibility, and with God's help, a better world." Thinking on these things, enumerating her grievances to himself, Kenny was fuming more than ever by the time he noticed Isaiah pulling up in front of the bus stop outside the Jitney Jungle, where Kenny sat clutching his skateboard in his arms. "Hey, Kenny man," Isaiah called, rolling down the electric windows of his parents' glossy black Olds 98, pushing open the passenger door as he swept a pile of compact disc cases off the passenger's floor. Kenny threw his skateboard into the back seat and clambered inside. "Sorry I'm late." "Huh?" Kenny said, glancing at the clock on the dashboard. The sky was dark violet now, the color of a bruise, and he had no idea what time it was. Usually it took Isaiah around 20 minutes to drive downtown from Woodley, the neighborhood in northwest Jackson, Kenny's father liked to say, where all the rich black people lived. "Bad stuff going down at home. My mother's really upset about that thing that happened down at City Hall today." He punched the gas and they shot up the Fortification Street hill. Isaiah glanced over at him, aquarium green light from the dashboard catching the lines of his face eerily. "Apparently this woman, this black woman," he added uncomfortably, "who worked for the city, was caught embezzling money from the payroll department and got fired." Isaiah spoke calmly and clearly, like an adult. He, unlike Kenny, was not an underachiever. "Except she, the woman, says her supervisor's lying, that it's a personal thing. So she appealed it to the council, but Mama didn't believe it and voted with all the, well, you know, white guys," Kenny added in the silent missing words. In that instant, the memory flashed through his mind of the first time Isaiah had come over to Kenny's house to spend the night. "Now why is it," Kenny's father said to Isaiah over his customary evening glass of vermin, "that you're named after not one but two Confederate generals?" Kenny had cringed inside. "So what happened?" Kenny said. Isaiah turned right onto State Street, the central artery that traversed the city. "So she gets to City Hall this morning, and there's this tire, like a car tire, on the steps, along with a sign saying, 'This is a necklace for Diana Jackson Lee and any other black council members if they ever again sell out Jackson's black community.' You know what that is, don't you, Kenny? A Haitian necklace?" "No. On their left, past the shining white hulk of the Baptist Hospital." "They do it like in the Caribbean and South Africa. They cover the tire in gasoline and put it around your neck and light it." He paused, and when he spoke again, his voice was rough and eerie. "It's how they watch you burn." He paused again, sniffed. "Bunch of idiots." Kenny sat dumbly, with no idea what to say. There'd never been this mood before when they hung out together. "Anyway," Isaiah said, his voice signaling a change in subject. Kenny's mouth widened involuntarily into a grin as the idea came to him. His body remembered the feeling of wind across his back as he ran lightly through the Madison subdivision. "You know what we ought to do, Isaiah," he said, sounding even to himself confident and slightly reckless, like somebody who knew what he was doing. "We ought to go get drunk." "Yeah," Isaiah said, as though it was a good idea that had just dawned on him as well. "Yeah, that's what we ought to do." They had only done this a couple of times before, including the last time, all at other people's houses. "I know this place on Northwest Street where we're here," Isaiah added. Then a second later, "Shoot, I forgot my money." "So did I," Kenny said. "You always forget your money, Kenny." He didn't act mad, though. "I'm going to go back to my house." Going north, he floored the accelerator, and the law firms and antebellum mansions peeled past as Kenny rode through the scattered CDs on the floorboards for something to listen to. Triumphantly, he came up with an album called Super Unknown by the group Soundgarden and fed the disc into the player's mouth. The inside of the Oldsmobile erupted into heavy guitar and screaming. It was magnificent. Isaiah was driving fast, and Kenny lowered the electric windows just to feel his face against the breeze. This was it. This was the life. They were out of the old part of town now, into the wide, seedy band of what had once been middle-class white Jackson, but was now ebbing into respectable working-class black. Unless you took the interstate, to get to Isaiah's, you had to go through there. Everywhere there were lights, at check cashing places and appliance stores. The streets were crawling with Friday night traffic, and everything was cool, normal, their conversational, typical, and random. What bands were coming to the Midnight Sun soon, and what were their odds on getting in? Who's the biggest asshole at Country Day and why? Whose parents at Country Day had the most money already, and whose parents just had to make it themselves? Which of their teachers used to get stoned, and how you could tell? How everything at Country Day sucked completely. And how even with tuition at $6,000 a year and the place being a waste of both money and time, both of them were still glad they didn't go to racist Jackson Prep, established only in 1970, just when, Kenny's mother said, the federal government came down and had the schools integrated. I could have gone to public school like my parents, Isaiah offered. The black elite, as they were sometimes called, had gone back then to Jim Hill High and Lanier, but now they all sent their kids to Country Day. The magnet program, of course. I couldn't have, Kenny said. His mother had gone to a girls' school somewhere in Virginia and his father to Phillips Exeter. There was no way with his Kenny could have gotten into either. People in the Birch Society were always asking how Sebastian and Nancy Brooks could send their only child to the most godless liberal school in town. But all Kenny's father said was, maybe I am a conservative, but I didn't raise my son to be a redneck fundamentalist. So as a result, here Kenny was with Isaiah Jackson Lee, whose mother had been secretary of the Urban League and whose father had once been some kind of militant. There was a faded black and white picture Isaiah carried around of his father with a huge afro and sunglasses standing in front of a fuzzball microphone at a press conference. The truth was, the reason that they were such good friends was because they were both geeks. Isaiah, though, had been to the Duke and Northfield Mount Hermon summer schools, and Mr. Lavenstein was giving him advanced-paced tutoring in Latin because Isaiah had always wanted to read Horace. Now, how come some of that doesn't rub off on you? His mother always asked him. Furthermore, compounding Isaiah's problems was the fact that the other members of Country Day's self-proclaimed black elite made fun of him for reading weird French poetry from the 19th century to white alternative music. He and Kenny also had headbanging in common, along with overbearing mothers in politics and lives tyrannized by Stanley Kaplan programs and the Educational Testing Service of Princeton, New Jersey. They were each also acolytes of two separate Episcopal churches in town. Not wanting Kenny to turn into a gloomy, reactionary atheist like his father, Kenny's mother had signed him up for the job at her church, where they used the 1928 Book of Common Prayer, and the priest was a retired Army colonel from the Vietnam War named Rex Rohatyn. She thought that the experience would be spiritually enlightening for him, but unfortunately she had not stopped to consider the main thing that acolytes do, namely to set candles on fire, which he enjoyed rather more than she would have liked, and had once, in her words, practically burned the place down. Someday, he and Isaiah planned, they were going to start a combination garage funk heavy metal band and play guitar in their cassocks with nothing on underneath. He'd get dates with the Jackson Prep girls then. Isaiah clearly had the edge, though, being smarter. Stereo Soundgarden was still playing, Black Hole Sun, Won't You Come and Wash Away the Rain. Just thinking about the lyrics made Kenny feel the oddest surge of power within him, as if he were become that sun itself. Every bit of Kendall Sebastian Brooks dried away and gone. A ball of fire he'd glow and be able to singe things like the prep girl's hair just by touching them. It was the kind of thing about which he liked thinking, and he wondered if Isaiah felt the same. Hey, Isaiah, Kenny said. What do you think the lyrics to that song Black Hole Sun mean? They were pulling into the semicircular driveway now, however, and Isaiah didn't answer him. The houses in Isaiah's neighborhood were dark, flat, low, expensive, and huge, set in the middle of giant green lawns and winding drives that smelled like the country. Kenny followed Isaiah through the garage into the kitchen where the dishwasher was running and the air full of hot mist from dinner. The house was decorated in a million shades of brown, framed prints of tribal women, and a dense layering of lighted mirrors in the dining room cabinet bar shelves. Hey, Mr. Lee, Kenny said as they passed Isaiah's father, who was sitting on the overstuffed white living room sofa watching TV. Good evening, Kenny, he said, grave and stentorian as usual, and then his beeper went off at his side. Isaiah's father, like everyone else's, was a lawyer. Kenny followed Isaiah to his room, where Isaiah looked for his wallet in the piles of laundry on the floor, while Kenny stared at Isaiah's computer screensaver in the framed, gargantuan biology class insect collection. When they were on their way back out, Isaiah's mother was standing in the kitchen. Barefooted in a silk robe, her long, relaxed hair was down and wild, flying out loosely into its spun strands. The front of her robe was low, and Kenny tried but could not help looking at her warm bronze skin and into the shadow of her cleavage. She looked as though she had been crying or drinking wine. Her eyes were water-rimmed, and her diamond earrings winked weakly. For some reason, standing there, she reminded Kenny of Hecuba, the old queen of Troy at the end of the Iliad that they'd had to read last year in school. When everybody was dead, she'd stood in the middle of the ruined streets and wailed. "Isaiah," she said, crazily rushing over and trying to hug him as if he were a baby. "Don't go out. Don't go out," she said. "It's dangerous out there." There was not a word from Isaiah's father, the ex-militant, in the next room. "It's cool, Mama, it's cool," Isaiah said, pushing her back and looking annoyed as he sauntered by. "I promise." She tried Kenny instead, patting him on the shoulder. "Make sure he's careful, will you, Kenny, son?" Kenny just smiled, but he couldn't think of anything to say. Then they were off, back into the night. The first thing they did was head back downtown to the Amoco station on Northwest Street, where Isaiah's father's cousin had worked since he got out of the state hospital at Whitfield. "This is my friend Kenny Brooks, Roderick," Isaiah said, introducing him as Kenny coolly slid two packs of Michelob onto the counter. "Kenny, this is my cousin Roderick." Kenny nodded politely, but Roderick was already off in conversation with Isaiah, speeding miles ahead of them. "Hey, man, how you doing? I ain't seen your mom in a while. I've been going to Vicksburg to the casinos any chance I get. You know, they got them free shuttle but leave from the Western Sizzling parking lot out on I-55? He was a tall, wiry black man, paler than Isaiah, his hair an unshaved flat top with a pink comb shoved idly in at the side, and the random, frenetic expression of a schizophrenic. This Kenny recognized. He had cousins, too. But as he stood there smiling again, he wondered what it felt like for Isaiah's family to be that close to the bottom, no matter how rich, successful, and smart all of them were. After all, Kenny's schizophrenic cousins didn't have to work in Amoco. "And you hadn't won nothing yet?" Isaiah said, lapsing into what he called the vernacular. "Not after having been over there all those times?" Unobtrusively, he handed his cousin a $10 bill. Without even looking, Roderick punched and the digital green total popped onto the LED display. "No, I hadn't won nothing, but the food is good, you hear me, and the drinks is free." He handed the change to Isaiah, Kenny already hefting the six packs in his arms. Behind him, the fuzzy TV security monitor and the "We Accept Food Stamp" sign, bright orange banner that proclaimed "We ID," appeared both futile and ironic. "You take care of yourself now, you hear?" Isaiah called back to Roderick, who smiled and nodded as the plate glass door swung shut behind them. "Nice to meet you," Kenny added. Then there was the question of where they were going to drink it. Isaiah thought that a second-story window of an abandoned warehouse across from City Hall would be good, while Kenny, thinking of that wind again against his back, that the top branches of the magnolia tree in his own damn yard would suit just fine. They ended up in the parking lot of a seedy strip mall on McWillie Drive, half hidden by a dumpster, the metallic lights of a laundromat brooding dully behind them. From there, they had an angle on the redneck sports bar across the street and the procession of loud-laughed, smoky-voiced women drifting intermittently out of its doors. Their exotic gestures were pronounced and filled with knowing. Their bright hair stylized and earrings dangled pendulously. There was something about them that it was at once both fascinating and disgusting. "It's like Kabuki theater," Isaiah said, slamming his third beer and chunking the can into the back seat. "No, it isn't," objected Kenny, who had also been to Japan. Still, they sat there, though, working their way systematically through the rest of the 2 6-packs, most or more or less in silence. After the Soundgarden album played a second time, they listened successively to groups with names like Alice in Chains, Marilyn Manson, and Nine Inch Nails. Then Isaiah pulled out of his pocket a package of Sherbetti clove cigarettes, and they shared a couple, the Olds 98 filling with thick, sweet smoke. But the more Kenny drank, the more his head filled up with crazy lightness, the more that the mere sight of the redneck girls grinding past on spike heels poured longing into his loins, the more he was unpleasantly surprised at how restless and dissatisfied he was. He and Isaiah were giggling at nothing, looking at girls pouring out the doors, but now it was only a drag and a bore. Everything would have been dreamy, yes, but it was also, he realized with horror, not unlike what sitting in class had felt like before his mother had gotten the therapist to put him on Ritalin to calm him down. "This sucks," he said to Isaiah. "Let's get out of here." "Yeah," he agreed and started to crank the car. The record stores were still open. They could go there. Or park in front of Alicia's house and see what time she gets home.
That was the Country Day homecoming queen Isaiah had an insufferable crush on, who'd actually once told him, "I don't care how smart you and Kenny are still insufferable bastards." Insufferable bastards. Kenny liked that, kind of. "She's just a slut," Kenny said encouragingly. "I wouldn't mind," Isaiah said, giggling, stubbing his sure-beady butt out in the ashtray. The vision of Isaiah's mother's chest and the wetness of her weeping eyes swept through Kenny's mind. Whatever he was upset about, he thought drunkenly, he'd like to fix. Then his mind reeled back. A 40-year-old woman, my God. Then Isaiah said, "Except the Wagon Hut guy will think I'm some black rapist." That was the security guard in Alicia's neighborhood. My hands were slippery on the keys. The engine coughed, started to turn over, and died. "Shoot, man, I forgot," he said. "I can't go anywhere. I'm drunk." Involuntary gurgles of laughter bubbled out of Kenny's throat. Almost at the same moment, it seemed, they noticed the bright yellow sign proclaiming Waffle House in capitals, hanging like a bilious moon over the interstate. Both of them giggling crazy, they slammed out of the car doors and bounded stumblingly across the strip mall lot, very nearly running into an enormous heaving woman loading bales of laundry into the back of her station wagon while her children squalled out the open windows. "Sorry," they yelled almost in unison, only a beat apart. The air smelled of oil and exhaust, but Kenny could feel the wind at last. It was exhilarating. When they stumbled through the Waffle House door, everything inside was warm and glittered. The music from the jukebox was loud. "Country," Isaiah groaned. Together they fed in a palm foot of full of quarters, punched in every remotely hard rock song on the deck, then sank down on either side of the booth. "What you want, honey?" the faceless waitress crooned, and they started pointing at the color menus randomly, each of them naming thing and all the choices running together in Kenny's mind. Eggs over easy, toast, two strips bacon, hot cakes, Belgian waffle with strawberry compote and real whipped cream, and coffee. Yes, coffee. The waitress's face snapped vividly into the sunny fluorescent haze. "Don't you go messing with me now," she growled, pointing her finger especially at Kenny. "I don't think you can get away with this foolishness any more than he can." Kenny and Isaiah just smirked at each other. Redneck racist, yeah, yeah. Still, they hesitated, reordered, and when the several bright plates arrived, almost as part of some giant steaming banner of grease, they devoured. Bacon crisp. Kenny could hear it crunch. Melted butter got between his fingers. Boiling coffee scalded his throat, but started slowly to restore his depth of vision, just as that song came on the jukebox again, repeating like a promise its insistent refrain, "Black hole sun, won't you come and wash away the rain?" The heat indeed was escalating, Kenny noticed uncomfortably, as his stomach filled and his nerves started jangle from the coffee. Isaiah was saying something, but it was incoherent or Kenny couldn't understand. He hoped, the wind again, that there was another beer waiting when he got back to the car. All at once, a voice cracked in the air like a gunshot. "How come you ain't on your own turf, North Jackson boys?" There, reclining in the next booth, his arms slung over the back of the booth lazily, was none other than his mother's public access nemesis, Elisha Speaks. Kenny and Isaiah flinched, suddenly feeling as vulnerable as spotlighted animals and instantly sober. "That old fool is nuts," Isaiah said, and added lowingly, "Vietnam." Isaiah asked the waitress for some more coffee, and Kenny slurped up another forkful of grits. But then it came again. "Where do you think you get off ignoring me like that?" he said, his voice astonishingly loud. "Cool it, Speaks," the waitress barked at him from over by the deep fryer. Nevertheless, to Kenny's and Isaiah's dismay, Speaks pulled himself out of the booth, tucked a stack of ragged paperbacks under his arm, and started limping toward them, wagging a gnarled finger in the air. First thing Kenny thought about was how short he was. Only about 5 feet tall, like a little doll, his head swaying back and forth so that his dreadlocks bounced like springs, crowned by an enormous crocheted African hat. He sank into the booth on Kenny's side and glared across at Isaiah. "Your mama," he said, "is a traitor." Occurrences like this and the sudden remembrance of a public identity were to Kenny not unfamiliar. "How can your mother really believe all that right-wing junk?" he'd actually been asked by the too cool Spanish teacher and soccer coach who'd just graduated from college and who looked disappointed when Kenny answered. This was on the soccer field during PE. "Hell if I know." Kenny was impressed at Isaiah's smooth response. "Mr. Speaks, I believe? I'm afraid I don't understand exactly that to which you're referring." "It's Reverend Speaks," he muttered, but Isaiah's words seemed to make him only angrier. "You know exactly what it is I'm talking about, boy. I'm talking about why come it is your mama won't stand up for the black people." He cut his eyes at Kenny, who in turn glanced at the pile of Speak's books on the table, four ragged yellow paperbacks with faded, anemic covers that looked like they came from the 60s. "African Liberation," screamed the top cover of the one on the top. Isaiah paused and spoke. "I'm aware that public servants' decisions are, in fact, often controversial ones, certainly." His Harvard voice. But he was still drunk enough, Kenny observed, that the voice fell flat. He couldn't get it right enough, like usual, to make it seem perfect. His eyelids made a nervous motion, the first sign of discomfort Kenny had seen him make. "Hey there!" Kenny exclaimed with a tennis club grin, inspired, reaching out his hand for Speaks to shake. "I'm Kendall Brooks. It's nice to meet you." Speaks glowered at him. The volcano in Isaiah burst. "Just tell me you didn't have nothing to do with that crap on the City Hall stairs," he boomed. The waitress broke in. "If y'all don't stop yelling, I'm gonna have to call the police." Speak's face assumed a "hey, don't look at me" expression. "I didn't have nothing to do with it, but I could sure make a bunch of good guesses who did." Not waiting for Isaiah to answer, Speak's turning, his tone laced with irony. "Kendall Brooks, you say? I think I recognize that name." "Oh yeah," Kenny said. Instantly, Isaiah regained his composure. This time, he got the Harvard voice right, sounding practically like Kenny's father. "Actually, we were just going," he said, casually ripping a $10 bill out of his wallet and dropping it on the table. "Yeah," Kenny echoed, "we were just leaving." Annoyingly, a country song now whined again on the jukebox. "I got friends in low places where the whiskey drowns and the beer chases." "Shut up," Kenny silently ordered the singer as they walked out the door. Speaks, however, was right behind them. "Let's just play it cool, mind our own business," Isaiah said softly to him. "He's just a crazy man. You don't think I, like, know that already?" Then Speaks muscled in front of them, walking backwards trying to command their attention. "You didn't think I'm gonna let y'all go just like that, did you?" "Frankly," Isaiah said, "I wasn't thinking about you at all." "Jerk," Kenny added. "You better watch that kind of language around Reverend Speaks," he said, snorting. "Kenny, you think people think alike just because they're black?" "Shut up, Kenny," Isaiah said, and Kenny did. Speaks was running backwards as fast as they could to keep up with him. Books in hand, making it look easy. "I ain't got no car," he shouted, his voice resounding in the hollow night air. "Can't you boys just give me enough money so I can get a ride home, you rich boys?" He must have seen Isaiah throw that tin on the table. "Forget it," Isaiah said. Suddenly, Speaks halted and threw his arms out as if to keep them from passing. "You gotta pay me if you want to cross the river." Isaiah shot Kenny a bewildered expression. Slowly, self-consciously, and grinning, Speaks reached inside the breast pocket of a shapeless lumber jacket and pulled out a pint bottle of Canadian Club whiskey that Kenny saw was almost full. "Y'all give me enough money for a cab ride home, I'll give you this." He held up the bottle in his hand. Under the streetlight, it was luminous, like some amulet that could ward off evil spirits. Isaiah pulled out his wallet, and Speaks handed Kenny the bottle. "Okay, is this enough?" Isaiah said, pulling out a 20 and extending it. The bill was crisp, new, impossibly green. "I knew what'd get you boys," Speaks started to croon. There was only an instant's glance from Isaiah to Kenny, a flash of recognition kindled between them. Isaiah pulled back the 20 before Speaks could grab hold of it, and he and Kenny were running as fast as they could toward the car, trying to stifle their laughter while Speaks yelled after them, "God damn you racist honky bastards!" They jumped in. Isaiah scratched out of the strip mall, past a couple of astonished laundromat faces, and Kenny turned up the CD player as they tore off in the direction of I-55. Once they were safely on it, its high, multiple-laned hum bearing them along toward downtown, Isaiah sighed. "Well, that was interesting." "You just need you some of this," Kenny said, tipping the Canadian Club bottled back and forth, watching the green dashboard light reflect through the glass. "Maybe I better go home now," Isaiah said. "Maybe for one night this has been interesting enough." The voice implied the evening's imminent end, a fate that Kenny, here he imagined his mother, bug-like and wriggling, wanted at all costs to avoid. "Don't listen to him, Isaiah." Isaiah glanced at him doubtfully. On his side of the car, the lights and stabilization pools of the old city sewage plant floated by dreamily. Kenny continued, "You've seen that stupid show of his after all. He's just a dumbass wino junkie." He had no idea if this were true, but at least it sounded good. At that, Isaiah's face relaxed and he laughed, pointed at the bottle in Kenny's hand that rippled with light. Then he said in a tone that sounded like a riddle, "If you were a wino, where would you go?" "Downtown." For blocks, the sidewalks were deserted. The only signs of activity were at the all-night neon-lit bonding companies clustered at the foot of the city jail. They parked next to City Hall in the space marked Reserved for D. Jackson Lee. Floodlights illuminated the facade of the massive white antebellum building. Its stand of columns and naked stairs lit up the lawn an unreal candyish green. Standing next to the tree that would, come December, be the Capitol Christmas tree, they opened the bottle and each took a swig. Isaiah practically spit his out on the sidewalk. "Geez, how can we drink this without chasers?" he said, then took another sip. Then the shadow of the night watchman paced across the front of the building. "We can't stay here, Kenny. We'll get into trouble." So they started walking. The tall glass headquarters of banks and insurance companies were massive and empty, steely against the sky. Their footsteps resounded on the concrete as they meandered along, passing the bottle back and forth between them. A persistent night wind was blowing down the street, chilly, but the Canadian Club warned them. They passed by the loading dock at the Clarion Ledger building, where men were shouldering stacks of Saturday papers onto trucks, barking at each other in staccato voices. "Where are we going?" Isaiah asked. "I don't know," Kenny answered, borne along now only by feeling. Like a river, the streets seemed to flow in toward the ancient railroad viaduct, suspended in the air a half mile in a distance. They began to pass buildings that were closed for the evening and others that were closed forever, where bare incandescent bulbs hung on cords, brooding behind soaked-up windows. And as they went, Isaiah seemed inexplicably to grow only more excited. When at last they arrived under the viaduct's massive shadow, Isaiah pointed up at the shell of the old railroad hotel next to it and said, "Didn't your family used to own that or something?" Sure enough, there it was, what was left of the King Edward Hotel, which once, famously, his Westerberg relatives had owned, and even now his mother was proud of the connection. For the Capital City chapter of the John Birch Society, she always ended every episode of the Access show, "This is Nancy Westerberg Brooks." He had never understood why. It was actually sort of embarrassing to him at Country Day, since the place was now just a broken-down old building. But Isaiah actually acted like it was, "How come you never talked about this before?" he said, crossing the street toward the chained entrance to the closed hotel's covered garage. "I don't know," Kenny said, following after. They were both drunk again by now, and it made him dizzy to try and focus. Isaiah stepped over the chain and strode across the concrete where no one had parked in nearly, dates Kenny's mother had mentioned before began to occur to him strangely, 30 years. "I think this must be the back entrance," Isaiah said, walking toward the outline of a boarded-up door. He sounded like an archaeologist. This was his Harvard voice again, the mania of someone who had amassed the largest insect collection in Country Day history. There was a scratch. A match flame flared at the end of Isaiah's fingers, picking out the door more clearly. Then the match went out. Isaiah tried the door, but it would not budge. "Oh, well," he said, walking back to where Kenny stood in the middle of the lot. "We probably ought to get out of here," Kenny said. All of a sudden, he realized he was very tired. But Isaiah lit another match, its tiny light illumining a surprisingly large circumference. "Wait, look," he said. "Isn't it amazing?" And Kenny had to admit that it was. Light from the outside filtered through a bank of chicken wire windows, and a ramp led upward to a second level, giving the effect of a vaulting in infinite space. It seemed to Kenny that he was standing in the middle of something timeless and still. This had once been his family's, he remembered again. The second match went out, but Isaiah had already lit another one and was climbing up the ramp, peering into the upper floor. "What the hell?" he said. "Kenny, there's something up here." All of a sudden, it was as though a light came on. A familiar voice boomed. "Aha! I caught you Jackson boys now. What the hell are you doing in here?" It was Speaks, a flashlight in his hand and a tricolored knapsack slung over his shoulder like some Rastafarian Santa Claus. "Ah!" Kenny blurted out, startled, running up the ramp toward where Isaiah was, thinking Speaks would want both his money and whiskey back now. "You hold up right there," Speaks yelled belligerently, chasing behind. But Kenny ran even faster until he reached the top of the ramp at the second level and saw what Isaiah saw. In the middle of the concrete floor, there was a fire blazing in an oil drum, its dancing flames reflecting a corona around the cavernous space. "Must be homeless people," Isaiah mumbled. Then the sound of slow footfalls echoed. "What is it?" a voice spoke, ringing clear and metallic on the air. Out of the parking garage's shadows, the figures of two men walked into the light. The weight of heavy gold chains glittered on them, around their necks and on their hands, but otherwise they were somehow featureless. One was even wearing sunglasses. The hand of the other moved down to his side, and through his hazy vision, Kenny saw a flash of duller metal in the man's hand. Crooks, drug dealers, the labels crowded haphazardly into his head. "Hello there," Isaiah said awkwardly. The whiskey was making him stumble over his words. "We didn't mean to interrupt or anything." "You didn't, did you?" he said. "Well, I can't help that now." The one in sunglasses walked over to Isaiah, then Kenny, thrusting his hands into their pockets, taking Isaiah's wallet and car keys. Then he walked back to the fire. After that, they all stood there motionless for a long minute. "Uh-huh," one said, and Kenny heard the unmistakable click of a handgun's hammer cocked. "But this is crazy," Isaiah blurted out, terrified, and by the firelight, Kenny could see that he was starting to cry. Suddenly, Kenny felt the stirrings of something new and unfamiliar within him, a feeling for Isaiah that was as tender and stinging as an open wound. Then it happened. "Okay, honky bastards, this is it," Speaks threatened, running up the ramp behind them with his dreadlocks flying. Too late, he saw the two indistinct men, their shadows lengthened by the fire into shapeless and distorted phantoms behind them, and he looked frantically at Kenny and Isaiah with an expression of solemn and apologetic recognition. The gun fired. "No," Kenny tried to yell, but the words confused themselves in his throat. All at once, he was horribly conscious of his inadequacy, of every second-rate thing he'd done and been. A vision came to him then, his mother descending from the sky in full martial fury upon him, the guardian of history and future, her gaze fierce and filled with knowledge. He did not try to escape her this time, but instead steeled his limbs, preparing himself for wherever, if ever, the bullet's pain would pierce him. Thank you.